What's good, family? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, the host of Black and Published podcast and the author of the forthcoming novel, The Seven Daughters of Dupree. This historical fiction novel is about the secrets kept between mothers and daughters over the course of seven generations and is told backwards in time from 1995 to 1860. The Seven Daughters of Dupree will be released on January 27th, 2026, but is available for pre-order now. So if you can, please consider pre-ordering The Seven Daughters of Dupree today.
Your ancestor's story is proof that strength and dignity endure even when everything else is taken away. When it comes to honoring that legacy, your privacy should never be in question. At AfricanAncestry.com, your story and your information belong to you. We destroy every DNA sample and never sell or share your data with anyone. Discover where in Africa your story began accurately and safely with AfricanAncestry.com.
I thank you all for coming. I truly do. I do not take it lightly, and I'm honored to have with us Alex L., a New York Times bestselling author, certified breathwork coach, and restorative writing teacher living in Maryland with her beautiful, beautiful family. She is the author of all the books as well. And I'm sure that you all have some of them. Writing came into her life by way of therapy and exploration of healing through journaling and mindfulness. And I would like to take the time just to publicly say thank you for your work, because it has also been definitely a blessing to my own life on my journey. I've been following this sister since like 1976. Look, I wasn't either. I came around in 79, but okay. But I'm grateful for you just the same. The intention behind Alex's work is to build community and healing practices through literature and language. She also teaches writing to heal workshops, courses, and retreats to assist others in finding their voices and create clarity, which is what we need in their lives and relationships. Our moderator for tonight, Alex L. And this thing here, Christine Platt, is a multi-hyphenate, multi-genre author whose work centers the journey of personal liberation and walk. And I think she just had her New York Fashion Week debut on the streets of New York, but Fashion Week and fine just the same. All right. Of course, we all know her by her best-selling book, The Afro-Minimalist Guide to Living with Less, which sparked a global movement around mindful consumption and identity-driven minimalism. Her forthcoming title, her newly released title, Less is Liberation, merges personal storytelling with broader social consciousness, and was recently selected by Malcolm Gladwell, Adam Grant, Susan Cain, and Danielle Pink as the next Big Ideas Book Club's October read. With each book, Christine affirms what she knows to be true. Liberation is not a destination. It is a way of being. And just like I did with Alex, I'm not going to get into it all. You know how I feel about you. I love you dearly. On a personal note, you know that you have also changed my life in many ways. And so I thank you. I love you. And also thank you for the way you love my kitty. She's a good auntie to my cat, Kitty Calhoun. All right, no. You all, thank you so much for being here with us. Congratulations again, and enjoy. A love letter to Black women.
Hey, girl.
Happy book birthday.
Thank you.
How you feeling today? I'm proud of you.
Thank you. I am feeling... Well, first, we should also say this is going to be like a super non-traditional author talk.
Yes.
Because we're friends in real life. Y'all know how when people come in and they ask the questions and they're like, so tell me, how was it to write your book? You know, we're not going to have one. We're going to have some real conversations, because I think we are in a moment that requires that. So you're asking how I feel about this book and it being out in the world today. I am emotional. Mm. I'm really emotional. I have cried a lot. You know, we have Yep. You have been a part of this journey. Chloe has been a part of this journey. My mom is here. She has been a part of this journey. And it was very different from writing The Afro-Minimalist Guide mm-hmm. because this book, I was writing upon reflection, right? So I was like, man, I'm going to write the book that I wish I had mm-hmm. when I was trying to learn how to let go of stuff. Excuse me. This book, I was writing in the midst of learning how to let go of limiting beliefs and identities. And it was tough. And I do want people to know it is a beautiful journey that you're about to go on, right? But there are parts of it, as you know, we talked about this, you have these moments of just awakening and awareness, and sometimes that's painful. Remember when we had the conversation about selfishness?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Y'all, first of all,
and
I didn't know.
And redefining selfishness. Yeah.
Alex, I'm like, I don't even know where to start. There would be so many moments when I would be working on this book, and I would have like a, oh my gosh. And I would be like, girl, guess what I just found out? Mm-hmm. And so selfishness was one of those things. And we were talking about how hard it is for women to be selfish because so many of us have been taught that it's a bad thing.
Right.
That it's an awful thing, that it's the last thing that we should be. And then we find ourselves so overwhelmed, so overburdened. And I decided to look up the definition of selfishness.
I think we both screamed.
And I had never heard the definition of selfishness in this way, which is being chiefly concerned with your own profit and pleasure.
Mm. Chiefly concerned.
Chiefly concerned.
Yeah.
This is in the dictionary
mm-hmm.
after the definition that we're all used to, right? Which is like a person who is so awful, they only care about themselves, you know? And
because God forbid somebody care about themselves, right?
And we ended up having a writing workshop about that.
We did.
Yeah. You want to tell the folks how that went? Can we close that door back there? Especially if I start crying, I don't need all that out in the hallway.
The writing workshop, I think, opened a lot of floodgates for people, specifically women, because we centered what we were doing together around filling our own well first and truly being chiefly concerned with ourselves outside of our roles from other people. And I think that that's how we kind of started our session. Is like, who are you outside of your roles to other people? Not mama, not wife, partner, sister, daughter. Who are you to you? Mm-hmm. And nobody knew.
It was wild.
It was really intense and sad. Mm-hmm. And it was a reflection for me because I too didn't know what it meant truly to be chiefly concerned with myself.
Yeah.
I've been a mother for half my adult life. Mm-hmm. My oldest will be 18 in November. I'm 36.
Crazy.
I had a baby at 18, which is, I don't know how I'm here, actually. The wildest thing. And then my littles are 20 months apart, and they are, how old are they? Six and seven.
Yeah.
Six and almost eight. And I completely lost myself in motherhood, mainly because I had so much shame around being a teen mother.
Yeah.
So when I met Ryan, I'm like, this is my only chance. This is the only man who is going to like me, who's going to love me and accept me and this baby. I meet him. We're married three years later. I thought, like, this is what I wanted. I'm like, okay, this is the life.
Mm-hmm.
Then we try to conceive Isla, all the miscarriages, all the things. Like, I was all consumed with my family.
Yeah.
And looking at my former self now as a 36-year-old, I'm like, I didn't know how to be chiefly concerned with myself. Mm-hmm. And I also was talking so much about self-care And I look back, I'm like, girl, what was you talking about? Like, you didn't know, not a daggone thing. But I think that was my way of trying to find my way, yeah. trying to fill my well, trying to learn what it looked like to center myself outside of my roles, because I've been somebody to somebody since I've been 18.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to know how you feel as an empty nester,
yeah.
writing this book, learning how to redefine selfishness within the past year and a half, mm-hmm. and what that's looked like for you.
It has been the most painful journey of my life. Mm-hmm. And that is largely because I am not 36. I will be 50 next year. And thank you. And I had to really acknowledge that I had spent the majority of my life being chiefly concerned with other people's profit and pleasure. And that was painful. Mm-hmm. That was really, really painful. And I think it happens to us as mothers. I think it happens to us as daughters. Shout out to firstborn daughters. Ciao. Right?
Shout out to only children shout who out are to the
only
daughters.
Children. I mean, like,
Jesus.
There are layers, you know what I mean, that come into this. And for so many of us, it starts when we're young.
Yeah. It's like right? we're groomed.
We are literally mm-hmm. groomed. There's mm-hmm. a part in the book, I want to actually read that. For those who have already started reading, you will be familiar with this love note. And I think it speaks directly to the question you just asked me. And it's on page 9 for those of you who have your books. And for those of you that read the Afro-Minimalist Guide, you know I have For the Culture call-outs in there. And I tried to do For the Culture call-outs for this book. And I just kept finding myself talking about black women, right? Like before, I think I could speak like generally talking about how overconsumption, you know, impacts black Americans. But with I just kept finding myself talking about black women. I did not know a single black woman who was only chiefly concerned with herself. Mm-hmm. And I sat down and I wrote almost unedited what I'm about to read to you all. And I sent it to my editor and I said, can I please change the For the Culture call outs to love notes to black women? And thank God I have a black woman editor. And she said, absolutely. Yeah. So I'm gonna read it to you now. A love note to black women. It's time to stop living a life of overwhelm. Oh, my dear sister, not only do I see you, but I have also been right where you are, doing exactly what you are doing, living in a constant state of being unwell. Because that is what the feeling we call overwhelm actually is, a sign, a symptom that we have not been caring for our overall well-being. Unfortunately, we tend to miss the warning until it is too late. Black women are a unique intersectional demographic, the most likely to survive being born prematurely, the most likely to pursue entrepreneurship, the most likely to enroll in higher education, the most likely to lead and participate in grassroots and community-centered organizations. At 92%, we are the most likely to vote and shape political landscapes. Somehow, we embody both the regality of our African ancestors before our legacies were altered by the transatlantic slave trade and the inherited expectations of our foremothers who were forced to till, toil, labor, birth, and nurture everything and everyone to prove their worth. Somehow, it seems we are able to do it all and look damn good doing it. We are highly capable, highly competent, highly versatile, and highly adaptable. No matter the task, we are highly dependable and will get the job done, even if it means taking on others' responsibilities in addition to our own. We do our work with confidence and grace, Our appearance is pristine. Our demeanor a reflection of the words of wisdom from the women who raised us on how to look and perform if we want to survive. Only when we are alone or in trusted company are we able to be honest with ourselves and one another. How we look does not always align with how we feel. We are worn and weary of everything we are expected to be and do, and everyone we are expected to fix and save. We have been of and in service to others since we were young. It seems we were born to mother. First our siblings and play cousins, then our partners, our lovers, our children, and others' children, and finally, when we are older, our parents and elders. All the while, we neglect mothering ourselves. Who we are is all we know. The Black women we grew up watching serve as the backbones of our families and communities are what many of us have become: overworked and underpaid, selfless and self-sacrificing, and that has to change. We have to change. Feeling overwhelmed is a biological trigger, an indicator that we are unwell. But because we have spent so much of our lives surviving, and unfortunately, believing we are thriving in this constant state of being, we no longer recognize when our bodies are pleading with us to pause, to take a moment. We no longer heed the warning to stop caring for everyone else and start caring for ourselves, until sadly, we face challenges that force us to prioritize our well-being. Until sadly, the lifelong compounded damage to our weathered bodies, minds, and souls cannot be undone. Being overwhelmed is costing Black women more than our livelihoods. It is costing us our lives. And that has to change. We have to change. We must simply learn to be intentional about honoring ourselves. Whew. I get so emotional when I read that. I remember sitting at my kitchen table writing it. And one of my neighbors, Courtney, she is a member of AKA Sorority. And I asked her, I was like, girl, you got some wine. I was trying to have a dry house. And she said, yeah, I have some wine. I was like, girl, come upstairs. I just wrote something. And I read it to her, and she burst into tears, like sobbing. And I said, I'm so sorry. Like, it made me emotional, too. And she said, Christine, I am the chapter president. I think she's like, for the region. And she said that she had to basically oversee 6 funerals during her term, during that time, and all the women, except for one, were under the age of 40. And I said, I think I'm gonna ask my editor to do this. And she said, please, 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 please. And we drank wine and we cried and cried and cried, because once you start doing this work, you realize, wow, I have really spent the majority of my life. And there's something about those words, chiefly concerned with my own profit and pleasure. I haven't been, but I have been for employers. Y'all, I done gave them the best, some of the best ideas and years of my life, and I can't get that back, right? All I can do is talk to other women and try and get them to understand you have to be chiefly concerned with your profit and pleasure. It is not your job, it is a job. And they will let you know that when it's time, right? But we give and we give and we give and we give, and we've been taught that we have to overperform, and we've been, and it just becomes a natural way of being. And I share this story in the book because obviously, I was overwhelmed. And I went for an annual checkup late, because y'all know, they got to call you 10 times. It's time, okay, right? And they're taking my vitals and doing all that, and they take my blood pressure. She's like, okay, I need you to sit still. I'm not moving. Okay, I'm like, she's like, sit still. And I was like, okay, I'm good. And she takes it again, runs out the room, runs back. I'm like, what is going on? I'm going to get the cardiac specialist. I didn't even know our practice had a cardiac specialist. I'm like, what? And I am just watching, and you know, your blood pressure, the more anxious you get, it's just going up and And the cardiac specialist comes, and I guess she can see my face. And she said, I want you to know, like, why we are just taking multiple readings. And she said, we're trying to decide if we should send you to the ER. When I tell y'all, I felt fine. Because overwhelm was my baseline. Overwhelm was my baseline. They are asking, are you drove here? Yeah, I drove here. And I had a meeting in the car, right? Like, and I had a conference call, you know. And I remember, and I write about this in the book because I never wanted to forget, there was a moment where I felt so annoyed that this appointment was going on, right? Like, I couldn't check my phone with this cuff on and, you know. And like, y'all, I had high stage 2, borderline stage 3 hypertension. I was on the cusp, literally a hypertensive crisis. One thing could have happened that day, and I would have, I could have had a stroke. It could have been anything. Yeah. And my doctor says, Christine, like, what is going on, you know? She's like, is it a partner? Like, girl, I ain't got time. You see me writing all these books. I ain't got time for no partner. What are you talking about? And she, you know, she's like, what's going on, right? I thought Nala's in college. I was like, she is. And I'm like, it's my job. That late, I will never forget how she turned. And she said, yo, job. She said, well, I really want you to think about that. And y'all, I thought about it the rest of that appointment. When I went to go pick up that medication, y'all, I felt like I was 100 years old, okay? Like, why am I on high blood pressure medication? And I was 47 at the time, right? I'm thinking of how hard I had been working, how much I had been doing, how I hadn't been caring for myself, how I hadn't been chiefly concerned with my own profit and pleasure. And as you go through this book and you go on your own journey, you're gonna have all these little epiphanies, right? And so when you ask how I felt, I think about all these little epiphanies. And one was, you know, I remember how many times over the course of my career I said, I don't have time to eat. That's crazy. Right? We've been there, sitting in front of that computer, going, oh, I ain't got time. Then we stand up, we dizzy, you know? And it's just like how conditioned we become, how we normalize that, right? Mm-hmm. And that is just the profit part. We ain't gonna get into the pleasure part. How we give of ourselves, hoping to be chosen, hoping, wishing, right? And all of that is wearing on us. And so what I want people to understand with this book is that overwhelm isn't just something, a word that we say, right? We have all said it a million times. Hey girl, how you doing? Girl, I'm so overwhelmed. Your body is trying to tell you something, right? If you cannot pinpoint, okay, it's this moment in my life, it's this thing that's happening, it's this book that's due, if it's a constant state of being, so we're not talking about a little moment of overwhelm here and there. We're going to be stressed. We got to be around other people. That in and of itself. Right. Right. We can't avoid being stressed, right? But when it when you go to bed overwhelmed and you wake up overwhelmed, mm-hmm. right? When you can't escape the overwhelm, that is your body trying to tell you something. And sadly, for so many of us, I'm first gen, like everything. God bless my mom for all the sacrifices that she's made and all the things that she's done to make sure I could be in this space that I'm in. Can we just give my mama a hand? I want her flowers. Give my mommy her flowers. But what that means is that I am first gen learning a lot. She didn't have time to think about wellness until you retired, you know? And I think that's common for a lot of Black families, right? I feel like so many of us, being able to think about your wellness and your health and making smoothies and doing that is a privilege, right? And I think we have a lot of unlearning to do, and we are the first generation to really have an opportunity to do that, and that's powerful. I think about how Charlie has seen you mm-hmm. your entire life. Even if you were calling it self-care, there was care of self, mm-hmm. right? Your daughters have seen it. They've mm-hmm. seen it with your books. They've seen you prioritize yourself, mm-hmm. and that's powerful. I think we often forget that we're modeling mm-hmm. for other young women, for our girls, how to show up in the world and care for themselves.
I often say healing by example versus leading by example, because the healing that we do really does trickle down to generations after us mm-hmm. and current ones. Like, my daughters are witnessing me choose myself in a way that I wish I'd seen my mother yeah. choose herself. Yeah. It's interesting that you said that overwhelm was your baseline. I think for me, self-abandonment was my baseline. Mm-hmm. And it was praised. Yeah. You give up all of yourself when you become a parent. You give up all of yourself when you become a partner. You give up all of yourself when you become a public figure who writes books. You give, you give, you give. And I turned 35, when I turned 35 last year, I was like, this is ghetto.
This ain't it. This ain't it.
I don't like it. And I deserve to take up space in my own life. Yes. And then I turned 36 this year, and I was like, oh, this is what it means to take up space in my own life. Mm-hmm. And it is interesting when we choose, like when we really start choosing ourselves, it is interesting to see yeah. all the ways we have not been choosing ourselves for all the years. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, maybe we have a partner who is content with us as we are. Maybe we have a job that pays the bills and is good enough. Maybe we don't want to work hard on ourselves mm-hmm. because it's easier to stay the same versus to change. Mm-hmm. But whatever the case may be, self-abandonment being my baseline was starting to show up in my life in ways that I just could not yeah. ignore. Yeah. I've talked to you about this, but I lost 35 pounds last year on my Peloton in my garage. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you.
And then I lost another almost 15 pounds this year doing Pilates. Pilates, I'm now becoming a Pilates, certified Pilates instructor.
Don't she look good, y'all?
Thank you. Thank you, thank you. And it's not even just about the physical. Yeah. I need everybody in this room to know that my mental is different. I am a different woman. I am yeah. a different person. And it is not because I've lost 45 pounds. I mean, praise be that I, if this ain't birth control, I don't know what is. I'm like, no. my body is back, you know? It belongs to me. I'm not nursing no more. I'm not, none of that. But all jokes aside, like, I felt disciplined for the first time in a long time. Mm-hmm. And in this transformation of mind, body, spirit, how I eat, I do not drink alcohol. Mm-hmm. I am on that Peloton twice a week now. I'm in Pilates studio 3 times a week now. I know that is a privilege to have the time to do that. However, I am choosing to show up for myself in my physical every single day in some way. Yeah. And I have realized, it clicked earlier this year. I said, God, please show me my divine path. I'm ready. I am ready. I am ready. And I didn't know what that pivot was going to look like. I didn't know what that path was going to be. But I was so open to learning how to center myself in my own life as I walked into 36. Yeah. And in this processing, I saw just how much I had settled mm-hmm. with being good enough, having the career, being financially free, having the man, having the kids. And I'm just like, but I don't have myself. Mm-hmm. I have completely untethered from the woman that I thought I would be. Yeah. And so coming back home to myself this season really has looked like chiefly mm-hmm. concerned, being chiefly concerned with myself yeah. and not apologizing for it.
Doesn't it feel so beautiful?
It feels beautiful, and it makes me feel really conflicted sometimes.
Yeah, it's hard. And I think, you know, I know how things can look on Instagram. And I just want to be very, very clear that
it's
this
fake.
Is a difficult journey.
It's difficult.
No, it's a very difficult journey.
And anyone telling you that healing is easy, that shedding is easy, that choosing yourself is easy is lying to you.
Yeah, they're like, just do it. This is not Nike. Mm-mm. Okay?
This is not, I wish.
Yes, it's going to be a journey.
Yes.
Right? And I'm so glad you mentioned the physical, because I think that's so important, especially for Black women. We going to always look good. So we going to have to just get that out. Ignore the physical. You look amazing. Congratulations, okay? How do you feel?
Right.
And I think that has been the scariest thing for me.
Yeah.
To look back on that day when I was diagnosed with high stage 2 hypertension and thinking I felt fine. Mm. And now that I know what well feels like. Mm. And looking back on that poor woman in that, and I'm like, no wonder they were running around. No wonder they were, right? But that was my baseline. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of us are unwell because we don't know what wellness
really is.
We don't even know what it looks like, yeah. feels like. It took me going to an integrative health doctor, and I just wanted to get off the high blood pressure medication. I'm telling y'all, I felt so old. It sounded like an old people disease. You know what I'm saying? Like, why do I have high blood pressure? And I really wanted to get off the medication. I ended up getting on Prozac because I was depressed about that. You know, like, this is what happens. It becomes this
cycle.
This cycle of medicating instead of treating. Getting to the heart of it, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Working with that sign and the symptom, overwhelm. Mm-hmm. And so we talked through my entire medical history. And my integrative health doctor is a Black woman. I share her name in this book. She is fabulous. She's here in the DMV. And I remember telling her part of my story, and she said, can I just stop you for a second? And I said, sure. She said, I just want to take off my doctor hat for a second. I said, okay. She said, you do know you're divinely protected, right? When I tell you, I've never had a doctor say that to me, right? And man, so we go through this appointment and we get to the end of the conversation piece, and she says, Christine, you are unwell. And I say, I know I have high blood pressure. but let's not
go there.
I mean,
like, geez,
that's a strong diagnosis, right? Like, I don't think I'm unwell, you know? And she said, have you ever heard of the five foundations of wellness? I said, no. She said, and this is not woo-woo. She said, you know, I used to work at Kaiser, and this is a diagnostic tool that we use in traditional medicine as well. And she said, we look at your physical health, right? What are you eating? How well are you sleeping, right? Are you moving? And she said, not once a day. I need you to move throughout the day, mm-hmm. right? Not mm-hmm. your 30-minute workout. I need, when your little watch buzzes, stand up, right? Like, move throughout the day. She said, we look at your mental health, right? We look to see, are you able, do you have an outlet to process mentally? What are your problem-solving skills like? I have some statistics in this book. Y'all gonna be frightened at how many people struggle. Well, no, you won't, because you'll be like, that makes perfect sense. That's why. We look at your emotional health, right? Can you emote? Is it a safe place? Do you have safe places to emote? When was the last time you actually released emotion besides anger, besides sadness? We have over 30 emotions. When was the last time you truly emoted, right? She said, we look at your social health. This is your interpersonal relationships, your friendships, your partners, your colleagues, right? Your village, as we like to say. She said, and then we look at your spiritual health. And she said, you know, obviously if you have a religious denomination, that's a part of that. But she said, it's also your purpose, like going beyond just your religious denomination. What is your, do you feel like you are doing meaningful work? Do you feel like you are adding value to this world, to your community?
What's the North Star of your life? Yeah.
And then Dr. G fixed her mouth to say, if any one of those areas of your health is compromised, a patient is deemed unwell. Well, I said, so you trying to tell me all these unwell people is running around out here? And she said, yes.
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 You too. She said, but the thing is, our bodies are always, always trying to help us be well. We just have to learn how to listen.
Yeah.
And I went home, and I know my publisher was so tired of me, y'all. I said, well, now I got to change the book again, because I had never heard of the five foundations of wellness. I'd never had a self-assessment tool. And I thought, if people had a self-assessment tool, how would that change when we have that feeling of overwhelm? Mm-hmm. If we pause to say, let me see what's off, right? I started to think of them as my personal wells. And so that's how I frame them in the book. And I know you remember I told you that. You were like, I love that. Yeah. Because for me, it allowed me to see what's draining me and what's filling me up, right? What is draining that well and making me unwell? And what can I do to fill it up so I am well, right? Mm-hmm. And so we begin to talk about, girl, we got to fill our wells. We got to fill the wells. And it really allows you to start to connect with yourself, which is what you were saying, right? We are disconnected. The fact that you are hungry, your stomach is rumbling.
And you won't eat. It's
and
crazy.
You won't eat because you got work to do. Mm-hmm. You're disconnected from yourself. Mm-hmm. You're unwell.
Well, you're abandoning yourself, too.
Yeah.
Like intentionally choosing not to nourish yourself.
And isn't it interesting, the words make a difference, right? Unwell hurt my feelings, right? Self-abandonment, self-neglect. That's what all this is, y'all. That's what we're saying. You are neglecting yourself. You are abandoning yourself. You are sacrificing your profit and pleasure and health for others. And the question I kept asking myself as I was working through this book is, why?
That's a great question.
Why?
Yeah.
And that is part of the work.
What did you come to? What was your why that was coming up for you?
You know, getting to the root of limiting beliefs. I feel like that is at the core of where we are. And I, you know, again, these are all like these buzzwords that you hear. I know no limiting belief. I'm like, I don't believe. What is a limiting belief? It doesn't even make sense, right? And so I had to learn about it in a way that made sense for me. And I think we're first gen. Ain't nobody ever said nothing about a limiting belief.
Nope.
In my family, in my life, right?
Ever.
What does that mean?
Right.
So I had to define it in a way that made sense for me. And you can read all the clinical definitions and psychology and pop psych, and it's like, that's not resonating. The way it resonated for me was a limiting belief forms when a messenger, and a messenger could be anyone, could be anything, institution. For a lot of us, the church is a messenger, okay? It can be anything that you respect, admire, value, want to seek approval from. So a lot of our parents were messengers. And it's when a messenger gives you the wrong message, knowingly or unknowingly. A lot of us form limiting beliefs unknowingly by messengers who loved us, who thought they were doing the right thing, right? Don't rest. You can sleep when you're dead.
Right. Like, how does that make any sense?
And we like, yup. Sleep when I'm dead, you know?
Like, well, when you're dead, you're dead. You're not
sleeping. You're dead. Get it.
First and foremost.
Right? And so getting people to understand how these limiting beliefs form, and I actually have us starting out with generational limiting beliefs, right? Because immediately the first thing you want, let me figure out who told me a limiting belief, right? And it's like, listen, the who is besides the point at this stage in our lives, right? But I understand the temptation to want to do that, right? And sometimes you'll be able to pinpoint it very easily, right? My mother said X, Y, and Z. My father said X, Y, and Z.
Can
my
I say
first grade
quick?
Teacher, yes.
Let me say something real quick before it goes away. Sorry to interrupt you. What I have realized is that a lot of us, this isn't true for all of us, but for a lot of us, we were raised by people who hated themselves. And because of that, they plant seeds of limiting beliefs and disconnection and being angry and hateful because they do not like themselves. Mm-hmm. And something that I vowed to, even as an 18-year-old, having Charlie, I was like, I am not going to be who raised me. I mean, I was baby wearing and breastfeeding at 18 in 2007. Yeah. Nobody was doing that. Yeah. All my friends was at the club. They was going to Love in DC, and then it turned to Drink. And I remember, just side note, I remember I wanted to go to the club so bad. I was like, I want to go to the club. I remember going to Love. Oh my God. In a bubble hem dress with a pixie cut and a bang.
It was the time.
I don't know if it was cute, but it was good enough. And I just remember like just wanting to feel normal, to feel like a normal 18-year-olds. I go, and we stand in line for a long time, and we get up front, and then my breath started leaking. And I didn't have my little cotton things. And I'm standing in line with my bubble hem dress, milk just dripping down to my yellow clogs. And I just remember thinking, I want to go home, and I can't have this life.
Yeah.
And I don't want this life. I was so torn because I was very young, like trying to stay a teenager, but also be somebody's mama. Mm-hmm. Be a good mother to somebody.
Yeah.
And there ain't nothing wrong going to the club. But when I was at that stage of my life, I was just remember feeling like I was floating. And like I was trying to create a life where I could have both versions of my girlhood and womanhood, when really I had to transition to being the mother and the woman that I wanted to be.
Yeah.
And I was going to start to hate myself if I continued to put myself in a position that I knew wasn't in alignment with the type of mother and woman that I wanted to be, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm sharing that because it takes radical self-choosing to untether from the life you wanted that is not the life you have.
Yes.
And it takes a lot of self-trust that you're going to create a beautiful life for yourself, your children, your people, when you choose to center not only joy, but deep healing. And your filling of the wells, I love that so much because I am reminded every day how if I am empty, if I am showing up at the club, if I am not in alignment with my life's North Star, I am going to continue to feel drained and depleted.
I love that you say that too. And I haven't forgotten about the limiting beliefs. I want to address that as well, because I'm on the opposite end as an empty nester. And that is also a big transition. You asked me about that in the beginning. And I think I spent that first year likewise in a daze, right? I mean, I had so much time. Again, it was so wild. And but there was also an emptiness that I felt because mothering had become a part of my identity. It was an mother being a mother is an identity.
Yeah.
Right? And if we're not careful, it can be all consuming. And I think there are parts of your life and your story and what you thought it was gonna be and what you hoped it would be and what you weren't able to do, that you have to grieve.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, okay, I'm now an empty nester. I can't be a dream or love or wherever. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm tired. It's 9 o'clock. You know what I mean? Like,
I'm in the bed. Yeah.
There are, and I've talked to other empty nesters, and, you know, like, when your kids are young, you'll say things like, man, there's a moment too. I think it's like they're like around 18 months to 2 years old, and you look at them and you like, I got 16.
16 months.
Oh, yes, Jesus. Right? You're like, man, when them 16 years go by, I'm gonna do this and I'm gonna do that, right? And then all of a sudden, you are an empty nester.
And you're not doing
nothing. Child, you can't even remember.
Nope, nothing.
You can't even remember, right?
But I also think it's important for us to, as on the motherhood front, to grieve our former selves and our former lives. Because if we do not, we can hate our children.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason why I'm saying that is because it's resentment. It may not always be hatred, but it's resentment.
Yeah.
I know for me, my mom did not enjoy being a mother.
Yeah.
And she did not enjoy being a mother.
Yeah. And that resentment feel like hatred.
Oh, yes.
To our children.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And it doesn't have to be words. they feel energy, mm-hmm. right? They have that those same mm-hmm. range of emotions. Mm-hmm. I've spoken to so many mothers, and we're like, where did you used to cry? And I'm like, I used to cry in the shower. Mm-hmm. Oh, me too. You know, that way if right. Nala came in, she would just see water on my face. And right. she went, you know what I mean? Like, it is a shared experience that is hard.
Yes.
Mothering and motherhood is hard.
And mothering ourselves.
And that's the thing, though.
Is
we
hard.
Know how to do it because we've done it mm-hmm. to others. We've done it for our children. We've done it for partners. We've done it for friends, right? But I think a big part of what you said is so important. And grief. And I talk about grief mm-hmm. in this book. And it's one of those things that we just don't allow ourselves to do enough, mm-hmm. right? I call it the trifecta trap in the book. It's these three emotions that I feel like more than any other keep us trapped in these lives of overwhelm and keep us in the lives that we are seeking freedom from, stopping us from getting to the lives that we are seeking freedom for. Mm-hmm. And that is guilt, shame, and regret. Gone and grieve it out. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Guilt, right? If I say no, what are they gonna? If I don't, what if, right? If I, but what if? What are they gonna think? What are they gonna say? What's gonna happen, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. We allow ourselves to be consumed by our past choices. Y'all, I said it in the first book. We are not grown. I know we like to think we are. It sounds so cute. We are growing.
Yeah.
Every damn day.
Yeah.
We are growing. And may we always be mm-hmm. growing, right? I mean, you can have a simple conversation with someone, and in that moment, you have a growth moment, right? And I think when we say things like, I'm grown, it gives this, like, I should know better. Mm. I'm grown. She grown. She's growing. Mm. It allows you to give yourself some compassion because it goes back to what we were saying. There's also this self-love, self-compassion, the same grace and care that we give to others. We have to learn how to give that mm-hmm. to ourselves. And when we go back to the limiting beliefs piece, because again, that's what's at the core of your overwhelm. That's what's at the core of you doing the most when you know you just don't have the capacity. Mm. That's what's at the core of your stomach rumbling and you not eating, right? Is a limiting belief that you can't stop working to eat, mm-hmm. to care for yourself, to nourish yourself, mm-hmm. right? And a lot of these limiting beliefs form when we're children. But I want you to keep in mind, they can form at any time throughout your life. It could have been a partner, right? In your 20s, in your 30s, right? Someone gave you the wrong message. Someone who you loved, respected, and admired, who you wanted to please, mm-hmm. who you wanted to make proud, and you held on to it. And now it is at the root of your overwhelm. And getting to the heart of that, right, is what I hoped I did in this book, is to give you a roadmap, right? Assess your wells. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about is doing that deep work. Assessing, asking why, right? I have all these little tricks and tools that I had to put into place because that's how deeply ingrained it was in me, right? Saying, I'm hungry, right? Mm-hmm. I'm hungry. I need to eat.
And
right?
Not even just like actually being hungry for food, but like what else are we hungry for? Mm-hmm. I am hungry emotionally. Yeah. I am hungry physically. Like, what is the thing? Like, figuring out what our hunger is. What are we hungering for? And, like, journaling about that, making a list. Like, what am I hungry for in this season of my life? And what have I been starving myself
That's that from? Assessment.
Right.
That's assessing.
Right.
And it's all those wells. So when we talk about assessing your wells, your physical well, I'm harping on food because, you know, I love to eat. But it's the same thing about sleeping.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Right? It's the same thing about moving.
Mm-hmm.
Right? When you assess that emotional well and you ask yourself, and I know, Ramonda, we got to go. I'm going to just say this.
Oh, we had time already?
No, but I see that look. She's like, okay. Because I just keep thinking about how deeply ingrained this is in us culturally. My daughter is in her senior year at Penn State.
Ooh.
Child, I can't wait to get all my money back.
Ooh.
Okay, woo! And so she took classes this summer semester. And she has just been hell-bent on finishing in 4 years, which means she has, her course load has been, it's been crazy the entire time. And then I wrote this book, and we're having this conversation a few months ago, and end of July, early August, we're in between summer classes ending, she's doing her finals, and fall classes are about to start in 2 to 3 weeks. Like, how are things going? How, you know, we're having that conversation. And you know your children. And when we were getting off the phone, it sounded like she was about to cry. So I call back, say, Nala, are you okay? Because you sounded like you were about to cry. And she said, Mommy, I felt like I wanted to, but I just didn't have time. But this is how it starts. You are 22. Your mother is scrimping, scrapping. You have no worries or concerns. You should have time to cry, right? Your tuition is paid. Your rent is paid. Your bills are paid. You have food.
Can you be my mama? Because of the Lord.
Girl. And I didn't want to in the moment because she's already stressed. I call back about a week later and I said, I want to go back to the conversation we had. And I said, it was very concerning for me that you didn't have time to cry. You should always have time to emote. And if you don't, then that's a problem. And I said, Nala, I really think you should look at taking this fall semester off. Classes were about to start in a week. A week ago, you didn't have time to cry, right? So you trying to tell me in the span of 2 weeks, now all of a sudden you're ready to take on another course load? And I'm doing my mother thing, and here's what I think, and it's your decision, but da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And when I ended my, got off my soapbox, I'm going to try not to cry. She said, Mommy, I just feel so seen. And she took the semester off. And that girl is having the time of her life. She is so happy. And, you know, like the first week or two, she just slept. Because I said, every day, I want to know what you're doing, right? Like, we're not replacing this with, I'm like, you're not going to get a job. You're not going to go do, you know what I mean? And I would just text her, you know, the little looking eyes emoji. Because, you know, that's how they talk, an emoji. So I would just, like, send her the little looking eyes emoji. And she would be like, I slept all day. And I'd be like, good, you know. And now, I mean, she's like going to the movies with her friends. And she's like, you know. And I would, you know, share this with some of my friends. And they would be like, man, I wish my mom would have did that for me, right? But that's the thing. We are in the best position to stop this. Mm-hmm. The only, and I won't say the only reason, but one of the reasons why she probably felt like she should just keep pushing and pushing and pushing is because that's what she saw her mama do. Mm-hmm. She ain't never seen her mama stop till I wrote this book, but her whole childhood, she saw her mother going and doing and getting up at 5 a.m. and doing this and that, right? And so it's my responsibility when we hear those little things, right? I could have glossed over it, and then it becomes a limiting belief that is rooted in her, which is, I have to just keep pushing through.
Yeah.
I don't have time to cry.
Yeah.
All right.
Hello.
Ramonda said I'm done.
That's my girl, but everybody, please help me give it up for Christine Platt. And Alex L.
Thank you. Thank you.
And so what I would love to do is open it up for Q&A for a few minutes here. And then we'll go into the book signing. So just raise your hand if you have a question, and I'll try to run to you. So, okay, this is easy. Yes.
Hi, my name is Kendra. Long story short, I'm a fired federal worker who took the summer vacation to go on naps and go to Mexico. So after the grieving process of the whole thing, I started my own law firm 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. And somebody sent me a job the other day, and she said, thank you.
Yes, yes. Shout out.
Someone sent me a job the other day for a CEO of an organization, and I said, I'm not interested in working for anyone else if my name is not on the door.
Ooh.
Unless it's going to help me pay for the law firm bills.
Right. Mm-hmm.
How do you navigate when you're working for yourself mm-hmm. and burnout is starting to creep in? Because it's like, I gave, you know, my career to my job. I gave my life to my career in the past, and now I've decided that I am my career.
Ooh.
But the question is I didn't eat before I came here, so I feel attacked. but yes, advice that you have when you are doing it for yourself, especially for y'all because you're authors and you have your own businesses.
Yeah, I mean, again, first of all, congratulations.
Yes, congratulations.
For getting out the matrix, girl. And it's hard, right? Because we do live in a society where we need money to live, unfortunately.
Darn.
it goes back to what I said in the beginning. You have to honor yourself. And there are limiting beliefs that we have inherited and that we believe that we think we can't. And it's just not true, right? There has never been a time that I've stopped to eat or take care of myself mm-hmm. or even go hang out with my friends and rub Chloe's belly, right? Mm-hmm. And like have, because you have to fill all the wells, right? You can't just fill that spiritual well with your work, right? Mm. You need that social well. You need to be around friends and community, right? Mm. You need to cry and grieve. I mean, the grief around having given so much of your career and your life to another organization, it's gonna come up, right? And instead of like pushing it down, you gotta let it out, right? You gotta talk to friends with that mental well and problem solve. Are there other attorneys, solo practitioners that you know, right? Like all of that is honoring yourself. So it's really when those limiting beliefs rise to the surface, you start to hear them, right? You're never gonna forget the food one because I harped on it. You always gonna eat going forward, right? But you know, saying I'm tired, that's your sign. It's not, let me give myself 5 more minutes. Let me give myself, like you have to start listening to what your body is trying to tell you. We all know, and we've all done it, we've done the push through, right? And the sacrifice and the toll it takes on our body, the next day it just ain't worth it. I'm never pulling an all-nighter. It's just not worth it, right? It's going to take me a whole day to recover, you know? So it's a practice, and don't feel attacked, okay? But do start to listen to yourself. And when you say those things, honor that. I'm hungry. Go eat. I'm thirsty. Have some water. You know what I mean? And when you see that your work doesn't fall apart, that your life doesn't fall apart from taking 2 seconds to have a sip of water or to stand up or walk, that's a limiting belief that you can't do something to take care of yourself, because if you do, the whole bottom is going to fall out. It's just not true. But you have to see it. And the only way you can see it is by honoring yourself.
Hold
on, I want to speak on that just
real
quick.
Of course.
I pencil myself in because I was diagnosed with ADHD after being misdiagnosed for many years when I was 34. I will forget to eat. I will be so caught up in my work that I'm just like, oh, I didn't eat, you know? Mm-hmm. So I pencil everything else in. I pencil my kids in. I pencil the family calendar in, my meetings in. I pencil myself in. I give myself a lunch break. Mm-hmm. And I don't, like, stray from that. I'm also someone who needs structure. I need to see it on my calendar, too, because if it's not there, it literally doesn't exist. That has happened many times. Like, oh, girl, we made plans. Are we still meeting? I say, oh, it was not on my calendar. And so that's just how my brain works. So if you have a brain similar to mine, or you just need help getting into your new normal, yes to everything Christine said, but also, like, be tactile. Mm-hmm. Put it in a planner, put it on your phone, have an alarm go off at lunchtime every day, and give yourself a 30-minute lunch break.
Yeah.
You deserve that, you need that, because if you're not well, your new business will not be well, the people you are serving will not be well. And so healing for ourselves, taking care of ourselves, is an act of community care. So that's what we have to look at it as.
Yeah. And sometimes we have to trick ourselves too, right? One of the things that I like to do is work with my computer not plugged into the charger.
So then it'll die.
Yes. Yes. And I learned that from another writer. She said, that's what she said. She said, because I'm like, man, I'm just always working. She was like, girl, unplug that computer. I was like, what?
I have another.
And And, you know, so sometimes until you get into the habit of it, that thing hurt too. You be seeing that battery go down. You be like, dang, right? But then, you plug it in, you go for a walk, you eat, you do whatever. You know what I mean? And then you come back and you get back to work.
Yeah. You're welcome. Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say that this is really a matter of life and death for so many. Christine, first of all, before I get to Christine, I just want to say this is amazing, because it takes a bad sister to be like the interlocutor for Christine. There you go. So well done to you.
Thank you.
And so I just wanted to say that I am someone who was diagnosed with stage 4 burnout. I almost died because of the things that you're talking about. And I just wanted to just acknowledge and say two things. One, this tension between a younger generation and folks who perhaps are a bit older, who grew up in a different time, who really have been conditioned very differently, was wonderful. And it was just what so many of us needed. So thank you for that. And then the last thing I just wanted to say was just thank you for writing this book, and that for those of us who have dealt with so many of the things that you're talking about, just to heed what you're talking about, because it can really save your life. And I just want to say thank you. That's it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Hello. Hi. I also want to say, just as the Afro-minimalist, you have changed a lot of things for me. So I really appreciate it. And I thought I bought too much, like, designer stuff. And I realized I didn't. That's the shit I like, so I keep buying. But I don't buy a lot of other stuff. So that is really important. And it's very helpful for me to also be able to buy more of the things that I really enjoy.
Right.
So I want to say thank you. But the next thing that I want to ask, because I feel like I'm a relatively healthy person and that I'm meeting a lot of my goals. But the thing that is really like a roadblock for me is outside, is the world. Mm. How do we less the world? Because right now it sucks badly.
Yeah.
I'm a neurodivergent Black woman who has the privilege of having been diagnosed in 2003. So I have been like making a schedule for myself, mm-hmm. and needing all these things and been able to pour into myself in ways that I know others haven't been privileged to do. Yeah. But I am unable currently to turn off how horrible everything is. And I would like any guidance. If it's in here, tell me the page.
It is in there. But you got to get to the end of the book, so I'm going You know, a big part of this work, the end game, is becoming sovereign. Mm. That's the end game. Mm. I am unmoved and unbothered by anything going on outside in the world that I can't control. Mm. And I am someone
Don't say that on social media. You get canceled now. But it's true.
And I'm saying this as someone who used to run served as the managing director mm-hmm. of the Anti-Racism Center at American University. Mm-hmm. This was my life's work, mm-hmm. was caring about marginalized individuals, mm-hmm. injustice, oppression. This was my work, right? Yes, right? It is, and that is in of itself, if you're not careful, it was a huge source of overwhelm and burnout for me. And when I think of that definition of selfishness, which is why I put it in there, chiefly concerned, not only concerned, chiefly concerned mm-hmm. with your profit and pleasure, you really don't have time to be thinking about what is going on outside in the world that you can't control, right? I am very concerned about what I can control, right? This is part of my work, right? I did a lot for my publisher to accept me saying, I'm going to have community conversations. You just also happen to be a New York Times bestselling author, but I'm like, I'm not gonna be in conversations with bestselling authors just to be in a conversation with the bestselling author.
Right.
Unless they have centered their work around liberation, healing, community, right? Mm-hmm. On Thursday, I am in conversation with Dr. G. I am in conversation with my integrative health doctor at Politics and Prose, mm-hmm. right? I don't need Union Market. I don't need to be in conversation with another author. Right. I need to be in conversation with someone where if someone in the audience has a question about their health, the person who is sitting there can answer it. Yep. If someone has a question about their healing, the person who is sitting there has written books that can guide them along that, right? And so it doesn't mean that you don't care. It just means chiefly concerned with your own profit and pleasure first and foremost. I know it's a very emotional, that definition, because when we say it, we realize how often we haven't been, right? There is no way I am going to be more concerned with what is going on outside in the world than I am myself, my mother, my daughter, my friend. There are layers before I get to what is going on over there in the White House where I can't do nothing. I can't do anything, right? What I can control is making sure that my daughter is able to emote this semester. What I can control is that we are in this room having a conversation that our parents, our grandmothers, our great-grandmothers mm-hmm. never in a million years imagined we would be able to have, mm-hmm. right? We have an opportunity to be cycle breakers, mm-hmm. all of us, for ourselves, for our families, for our communities. That's the work. That's the work. And do not allow limiting beliefs to tell you otherwise. Black women have always felt like we've had to save this country. Mm-hmm. Right? It's literally blood memory. Mm. This is what our foremothers had to do. Mm. We don't have to do it. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. I want more than anything, if there's anything that you all take away from this book, it is becoming chiefly concerned with your own profit and pleasure, first and foremost, so that you learn to be sovereign and centered and grounded, no matter what is rocking and going on all around you. Yes. That is the work. Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
We'll have time for one more question, and then we'll go to the book signing piece. And I think it was a, yes.
Also, I'm so glad to see you emoting. Good, good, good. Good, good.
Hi. Thank you so much for this talk. Hi, Alex. The thing that kind of has been pressing on my heart is just thinking about career disappointments. You know, just, yeah, I'm glad I'm not alone. you know, like just growing up, especially in my own family, just the focus on education, going to college, you know, doing all the things. Yeah. And you do all the things. You kind of get into the mindset of like, okay, when I finish college, I'm going to get into this big job and so on and so forth. And by a certain time, I don't know, be a millionaire. I don't know, whatever.
Yeah.
Obviously, in my life, that did not. It did not manifest that way. And I've kind of been in a spot for the last few years just thinking about, okay, what do I want to do differently? Yeah. And in a good way, like I've been able to identify those things and I know what I want, but it's like those in-between moments I find it still challenging because I'm thinking about like I need to be financially stable before I make certain jumps. As much as I would like to just immediately jump into the next thing, I can't, you know, because of my own personal responsibilities. So how do you navigate that? Like, you know what you want to do and you have maybe a plan and all those things, but the real life realities of like bills got to be paid, you know. I like food too, you know. I like my little sweet treats, so I want to be able to afford
that.
This
as writers, yeah, too, because I mean it'd be looking like we have financial stability, but child, this is a lot being a writer. You know, I think they're all, when I hear the term financial stability, it's also rooted in a limiting belief, right? It just is. You know, I used to work at the Department of Energy. I did a lot. I worked a lot, y'all, okay? And I used to work for their weatherization assistance program, which provided energy efficiency and renewable energy retrofits for low-income families and communities. As you can imagine, that program was one of the first to go during this administration. All my colleagues, all the work that we did, gone. And this month makes 10 years that I resigned from that role. And when I resigned, I was GS-15, getting ready to be SES. Oh, I know, right? It sounds so good. God bless all the older black women who were there. They were just so proud of me. They had never, you know, we'd never seen nobody get past a GS-11. We've never, you know what I mean? They were so proud. And they just did not want me to leave, right? You could be SES. You can, you know. And I felt like this writing was my calling, right? It's my first book that I independently published, The Truth About Owiti. It awakened something in me. And I'm like, I gotta leave this job, right? And they said, well, can you just take like a year sabbatical? And I said, now, let me just also say, you know, this kind of stuff you do. I was young. Child, had they asked me today, I might have said, you know what I mean? I don't know. But back then, you know, but that's how confident you have to be in your calling and what you want. I said, I ain't taking no sabbatical, because if I take a sabbatical, then I'm going to always know I have this to fall back on. Child, a number of times over the years I had wished I had taken that sabbatical, right? And I say that to say, you're always going to, when you take those risks to pursue your dreams, there's always going to be those moments when you're like, what if I just would have stayed, right? I do a book proposal and it doesn't go through, right? It gets rejected. Man, I should have stayed at that good government job, right? I don't think that it is just irony that it's 10 years to the date that I have this book coming out, and that good government job is gone. Right? That good government job is gone, right? And so I think oftentimes we tell ourselves limiting beliefs, tell ourselves that because it's fear, right? Mm-hmm. Or it's good government job is a term that was handed down right. to me right. generationally, right?
Yeah.
It was, you gonna leave that good government job.
Like, why right? would you do that?
Right? And so you start to believe this is a good government job. I should not leave. Right? And I think, I can see it across every industry I've worked in, from law to academia, right? I could always justify staying, right? And being uncomfortable, not living in alignment, not living out my purpose, and we know because it doesn't feel good. That social, that spiritual well stays drained, right? Doesn't matter how much work you're doing.
Yeah.
That spiritual well, that I don't feel fulfilled. My life was filled with things to do, but I wasn't fulfilled.
Right, right, right.
You know?
For me, so I started writing books when I was 23. I was self-published at first and then started getting approached by publishers and then started getting really, really big advances and like all of these things. I made my first $1 million. I was probably 30 when I made my first $1 million off of books. And I'm sharing that because my mama thought I was crazy to quit my job at 23.
With a baby.
With a baby. She's like, who is going to take care of this baby? I said, I'm going to take care of this baby. She's like, you're not going to have health insurance. I was like, Mom, I can get private health insurance. It's okay. Mm-hmm. But her fear was that I was going to be a struggling writer, artist for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And that her limiting, if I would have believed my mother's fear for my life, I would have still been at that nonprofit in DuPont Circle, still being just annoyed every day walking into that office. Mm-hmm. And at 23, 24, I left that job. I chose that I was either going to fly or I was going to fail, but I was not going to not try. And I stood on the corner at DuPont Circle, and I called my mama who worked on M Street, and I said, I just quit my job. And I had quit my, hey, let me tell y'all how God works. I'm gonna be like real, real quick. But
it's like church service. I was, it's gonna end, but it's not gonna end.
I knew I wanted to leave the job I was at. I was in college, online college. I was making jewelry to make ends meet. And I had this book, and I was it was called Words from a Wanderer. Mm-hmm. People still say they read that book. It makes me cringe. Cringe. Somebody saw me a couple weeks ago and was like, I still have that book on my nightstand. And I was like, burn it. But I knew that I wanted to work for myself.
Yeah.
And I put my 2 weeks in at that nonprofit. My boss was an ass. Mm. He was terrible. I put my 2 weeks in, and he begged me to stay. We'll give you more money, we'll give you a new position. And I'm like, okay, well, this is my sign that I'm supposed to stay here. And so I stayed. And then literally 2 weeks later to the day, that man came into, if you read After the Rain, you know this story. Mm-hmm. But he came into a back office. I was helping with birthday decorations for a colleague. And he said, you're not supposed to be back here. You're supposed to be at the front. Mm. I was the administrative assistant, whatever I was back then. And I said, oh, I'm just helping with the, and he said, don't forget your place here. Mm. Remember, we don't need you here. Mm. Though in front of people. Mm. And I got up. And I quit on the spot. Mm-hmm. I said, you know what? You're right. And I think I namaste bowed at him. Literally. And I said, I'm out of here. And he said, are you really about to do this? And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, I'll be deactivating your smart trip card. So that he thought wasn't going to be able to get home. Like, I'm going home. But it was in that, like, that. First of all, not only was that abusive, it was harmful. It was rooted in keeping this young black girl exactly where I want her to be. Mm-hmm. And I decided from that day forward, I was like, I'm never working for anybody ever again in my life. I don't care if I have to clean houses. I don't care if this doesn't work. I will do whatever it is. Mm. And 2 weeks later after that, Ohio State University booked me for my first speaking gig. Mm. And I was like, I got paid more money than I had ever gotten. It was like $2,500 for to be on a panel. And I was just like, wow. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking from that day on that I can believe in myself. I don't have to believe in an employer. I don't have to believe in my mother, respectfully. I don't have to take on her fear. Mm-hmm. That does not have to become my truth, right? Yeah. And so book writing, I mean, has been a blessing, but I truly believe that it has been spirit telling me, Alex, you have to tell your story. You have no choice but to be the matriarch of healing for your lineage. And by way of doing this, by way of writing, you are going to be healing not only yourself, but your daughters, your future daughters, because at that time it was just me and Charlie, your mother, your grandmother. You have a duty here. You have a duty here. Yeah. And in this duty, you must listen to me. And so whatever your duty is, whatever your North Star is, you will find your way, but you cannot stay small and at the mercy of someone else to get there. You have to surrender deeply into what you are being called here to do.
Yeah, and you know what it is because it keeps nagging.
It's never gonna go away. Mm-mm. You can try, it'll never go away. If you continue to turn your back on what you're being called to do, the phone will keep ringing and keep ringing and keep ringing until the day you transition off this earth. Yeah. And you don't want to be at that place trying to answer the call. Yeah. Mm. You want to answer it while you are well and able. So amen.
Amen.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah. Come on, Reverend.
Yes, yes. First of all, again, I just want to say thank you. You are someone dear to me in a personal space, and you know this, but I just want to say thank you. You could have kicked this book tour off anywhere, and you were texting like, sis, I'm coming to you. And I'm just grateful for your friendship, for the sisterhood, and for all of you that just get to come out here and have this conversation in this moment. And Alex, you know you bad too. But it's important to me as a black woman to be in this space, to have a business that is able to create moments like this. It's not lost on me, too. People think it's just books, but it is so deep. It is deep work to me. Mm. And these moments and these experiences are deep to me. So thank you for taking time out of your day, taking time away from your kids, your homework, your job, all the things, just to be here and be in community tonight. So thank you again. I can't wait to get into this book. It got to my house a few days ago, and I'm all excited. because the Afro-Minimalist Guide changed my life, too. Mm-hmm. And so, as you know, we went on like a whole felt like I was preaching, telling everybody to go get this book. And so I'm excited to tell people to go get this book, too, because I know you, and I know your intention, I know the space that you operate in, so I can't wait for more people to get liberated from your words and your bravery and your courage to put that down on paper. So thank you. Thank you.
Yes.
So please give it up for Christine Platt and Alex L. Woo! And your mama, too. And your mom, too.
What's going on, family? This is Derek Young.
And Ramonda Young.
Owners of both Mahogany Books and the Mahogany Books Podcast Network.
We really want to thank each and every one of you for listening to this episode. And if you enjoyed what you just heard, drop us a review and rate us on whatever platform you download podcasts on.
We truly appreciate each and every one of you for supporting us and making us your go-to for Black books. And we look forward to connecting with you all sometime in the future.
Thank you again, fam. And always remember, Black books matter.